I'm Christopher Lydon. Here's the question. Through the electronic looking glass, past the digital frontier, who owns what? In the world of musical recordings, it's the Napster question, whether anybody can exercise real ownership of the music after it's been digitized into a form that makes it easily, infinitely copyable. But now there's a fighting issue, too, in writers' world, particularly among the thousands of freelance contributors to newspapers and magazines. Before the U.S. Supreme Court this week, here's the question. If opinion pieces, profiles, reviews, and recipes have e-value beyond today's paper, should the authors be in on the new revenues? Newspapers led by the New York Times are saying they bought those freelance pieces once for all time, and cyber copies are just the late, late edition anyway. The writers say, no, you're making new money from new media, and some of it's ours. The freelancers' fight with the publishers is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming of this program was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. And from Harvey Silverglate, co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses, now in a Harper Perennial paperback. Also from artist Michael Mazur, whose retrospective exhibit, The Prince of Michael Mazur, is at the Minneapolis Institute of Art this spring. And from the 1999 Bollingen poet Robert Creeley, trust to good verses then. I'm Christopher Lydon. Let's say you write a witty, poignant Mother's Day tribute for the op-ed page of the New York Times. It not only thrills your mother, it becomes a sort of classic in the language, and everybody wants a copy. You retain the copyright, but people don't come to you for copies. They go to the New York Times and the LexisNexis reprint service on the internet, and they pay, say, $3 a pop to download your prose. How much of that $3 should be yours, dear writer? It's the question behind the Supreme Court argument tomorrow in the case that Jonathan Tessini and the National Writers Union have brought against the New York Times and other publishers. The question for this hour is, who can spell out the rights of authors and creators in the digital age? Our call-in phone is 617-450-2923. Our guests are all interested parties and their advocates. Jonathan Tessini for the writers, lawyers Lawrence Tribe and Kenneth Starr, who will be arguing for the publishers before the High Court, the lawyer-writer Wendy Kaminer, and the cyber cowboy John Perry Barlow. Give them each and all a call at 617-450-2923. Wendy Kaminer, get us started and speak for the aggrieved parties, in this case starting out, the writers. For a writer who's had the satisfaction of appearing in the New York Times and been paid for it, what's the problem?
I'm paid once for my articles in the New York Times, and when I submit an article to the Times, don't have a written agreement that gives them any rights to subsequent publication. All they have is the right to publish it once. The New York Times is claiming, and other publishers are claiming, that their right to publish once includes the right to sell copies of my article and all the other individual articles in the Times to various electronic databases. Writers are claiming that if the New York Times is making money off of selling their work, the writers ought to at least get a piece of that.
Is money being made on these reprints or the downloading of old op-eds?
I don't believe that the New York Times is giving away articles to these electronic databases.
But is the money worth fighting over, should we say?
The money may well be worth fighting over in the future. But it's not just money that we're fighting over. It's the right to control our work. What if I don't want to give the New York Times permission to put my work out on the web because that greatly cheapens the copyright? Because that means that my right to resell it, that my right to republish it, has been made essentially worthless. What if I don't want a lot of other people editing my work without asking my permission? There are control issues as well as financial issues.
Let me ask you, in the pre-electronic days, if I had heard about your piece, written to the New York Times and said, would you send me either the paper or the article that Wendy Kaminer wrote? And they said, yeah, there's a $3 service charge for this, and I pay it. Would you expect to get some of that money?
No, I wouldn't. And I don't know that
the
New York Times...
So what's different here?
First of all, the New York Times is... These publishers are getting paid. They're making money off of selling my article. If somebody goes to a library and reads a newspaper, the library is already paid for the newspaper. The person doesn't have a right to copy the article and sell it to all of his friends because that's an infringement of my copyright. That's essentially what the New York Times is doing. The New York Times is infringing my copyright.
I want to hear from the New York Times lawyer, Lawrence Tribe, who teaches constitutional law at the Harvard Law School. Larry Tribe, why not share the money that the New York Times makes on electronic reprints?
Well, it's being shared. The royalties for a very long time have been set with everyone knowing that when the newspaper gets the right to print someone's article, it also gets the right to have that article appear as part of the same newspaper on microfilm, for example. And what we're now talking about is just a fancier version of microfilm in CD-ROMs and then on the Internet. It's quite misleading to say, as Wendy Kaminar does, that the individual article is being sold by the New York Times. If the New York Times responded to some person who said, I really loved Wendy Kaminar's op-ed, would you send it to me? And if they sent the article separately and got money for it, of course that would be a violation of her copyright, because under existing law, Wendy has the right to make use of her individual article. She can serialize it, she can make it if it's a story, she can sell movie rights. She could do all kinds of things, but the right that Congress in 1976 quite rightly reserved to the newspaper or the magazine, because I'm also in this case representing Sports Illustrated, that right is the right to republish the periodical itself or a revision of that periodical, and what we're doing is publishing electronic revisions, putting them on the Internet, and the law very clearly says publish the article as part of that revision. In fact, it's not true that, I think in the intro you said something, Chris, about $3 a pop to download your prose. That's not the way this works. People don't pay to download even the most deathless prose. They pay to search the entire periodical. In Nexus, the charges are based on how much time you're on the computer. When we sell the CD-ROMs, which contain complete electronic digital copies of whole newspapers, people pay to get the whole newspaper. Now, of course, they can zero in on an article if they want to, but that's a very different thing.
You pay different
and in
rates.
Fact,
and different...
One point I want to add, Chris, it's very important. In this case, there was a lot of testimony taken in the district court on whether the availability of someone's work in this digital form so that it could be downloaded together with the rest of the paper and someone could zero in on it, whether that cut into their market for serializing or for syndicating their work or for getting various kinds of derivative work from it, the answer was not at all. There was not a penny of loss. So I think that in terms of the fair allocation between freelancers and publishers, this is a tempest in a teapot, but it's not a tempest in a teapot when you consider what would happen if they were to win. If they were to win, any publisher would realize that there is a possibility of massive damages from hundreds of thousands of articles out there in the past, which would have to get deleted to avoid the possibility of statutory damages. And that's why the historians have weighed in, a number of them, Doris Kearns Goodwin and David McCullough and others, saying that it would be really a serious blow to their research to have the case come out that way.
Larry, you said that the publisher would have to dump all this good stuff rather than get caught with it. They could also just pay for it.
Well, that, you have to find people before you can pay them. There are 100,000 freelance articles on Nexus alone. It includes 18,000 periodicals. But there's no practical way to find, let alone get releases from all the authors, their heirs, their assigns.
That I must say, that sounds like a very feeble effort, Larry. If we had a mountain of stolen property here...
But it's not stolen.
Property that you can't use and sell and keep on your premises, and you said, well, rather than pay for it, we'll just despair of ever finding this article by Wendy Kaminar, or where she lives now.
Chris, it's not unrealistic at all.
Well,
U.S. News, for example, has already decided that it cannot afford any longer to put its freelance articles on microfilm, because if this case comes out the wrong way, even with very recent pieces, they might have trouble. I'm talking about going back 25 years. It's not easy to dig up all the people and make deals with them, especially since any of them could basically hold you up. That is, if somebody says, well, I'm really happy to have my stuff on the Internet, but I realize that unless they pay me, I can make them take the entire edition of that newspaper off the Internet because it's not worth anything except as a complete edition.
Professor Tribe, you know that the Writers Union has proposed a method of payment. They
have a
clearinghouse. And I know you're talking about previously illegally published articles.
My understanding
is that the court could decide that if it holds for the Writers Union not to apply that decision retroactively.
No, that's
questions
wrong, Wendy.
Of damages.
That's completely wrong. All nine justices have said that even though they can do that in a constitutional case, they can't say that what Congress wrote in 1976 meant one thing until we rule and means something else from today. That simply can't be done.
So, in other words, your argument is that even if the court holds that they were doing something illegal, if they've been acting illegally for the last 25 years, we should continue to allow them to act illegally because the remedy
for their illegal actions are just
too harsh.
No, you have it backwards.
No, that seems to me what you're saying. You're saying it's too expensive to pay for the stolen material.
No, excuse me, Wendy. I'm saying that what they're doing is clearly in accord with what everyone understood to be legal.
That's not true. If that were true, you wouldn't be arguing in court.
What you're saying is they should change the law now and make it purely prospective. And I'm just saying that's not an option that they've got.
Professor Tribe, not everybody agreed that what they were doing was legal. That's why the Writers Union brought this lawsuit. And I think that your analogy to the microfilm is really misplaced, because when I go into Lexis to look for an individual article, I'm not getting the entire edition from the New York Times intact. I'm getting individual articles. When I go to the library and when I look up microfilm, I can get entire editions of the Times on microfilm.
Well,
and then I have to go through and I have to look for my article. And that was one of the points that the Second Circuit made when it ruled for the Writers Union.
I know the Second Circuit made it, but the reason I think the Second Circuit was not being very persuasive is that with microfilm, you use the reader's guide to zero in on the place you want to look. Unless you're really got nothing better to do, you're not likely to read the whole thing. Likewise, when you go into LexisNexis, you've got the whole thing there with an instruction of about six letters. You say date, and you give the date, you press a button, you could get the whole thing. If you zero in on one article, it's really no different whether you do it on microfilm or on Lexis. And certainly the CD-ROMs, which are involved in this case, are completely indistinguishable from microfilm. One of them, the General Periodicals on Print, has a photographic copy of the entire newspaper, the Sunday New York Times Magazine, and the book review section. And the only difference is that it's on a disc instead of on tape.
Larry, could I ask, you're saying that the LexisNexis electronic service is really just another form of microfilm, but I know, millions of people know from their own experience, that LexisNexis is A, infinitely easy to use in the comfort of your own office or home. Secondly, it's easy for the owners to put a charge on, and they do. Why not grant that electronic publication constitutes a new use of an old article? It involves a new revenue stream for the publisher and might easily be shared with the author.
I think we have to focus on the difference between the past and the future. When Wendy sits down to negotiate with the New York Times...
I don't negotiate with the New York Times. I have no negotiating power.
And you're not going to get any more. In other words, you're going to get two royalty checks in the future instead of one. And do you have any reason to think that the total will be higher? In other words, neither you nor the New York Times is ignorant. Everybody knows that the stuff is being made easily accessible electronically. That's part of what the copyright laws are designed to do, to facilitate dissemination. And when the price is set for the piece that you write, everyone is aware that that piece is going to be available in a lot of ways.
It's actually not true that everybody is aware of that. Writers have not been aware for the last 10 or 15 years that their works were being republished electronically without their permission.
You don't change the law to make people aware of it.
I don't think the writers are the ones who are changing the law. I think the publishers are the ones who are changing the law, and that's what you're arguing about before the court this week.
That's right. We'll certainly be arguing about that, but it seems to me very unrealistic to think, once you inform everybody of their rights. See, this is not one of those copyright cases where people who are complete strangers to one another try to decide how to divide up the pie. These people are in the same bed contractually. They're setting a price. What a fair price might be is not going to be regulated by the government in any event. And the question, for example, in 1993, the New York Times, with this case coming along, decided to be explicit with all freelancers to say, when you sell us your piece, you're selling us the electronic rights too. If you don't want to, we don't want your piece. The royalties did not change one cent when that was announced. And there's no reason to think, if the freelancers were
not,
to
not
win
all
this
writers
case,
signed
that they
those
change.
Agreements.
I'm sorry, I didn't
not
hear you.
Not all writers signed those agreements. I can tell you that I never did, and I've written for the New York Times for
well,
the last
you know,
10 years.
If you
are you writing any more, Wendy?
I just did something for them last week.
But they've made it clear that they're not going to recognize print-only rights.
They've made it clear to me that they're not going to respect copyright law. I've never signed anything
what
that
you,
gives
what,
them permission
what
to republish
think
my articles.
What do you think the New York Times or any other newspaper should do about someone who doesn't want their piece to appear electronically? One option they have is simply not to run it. Another option is to put their newspaper like Swiss cheese with holes in it on the internet and on CD-ROMs. That's not realistic because one thing people want in these products is to get the whole periodical. That's a technological reality. And
Larry,
what
do you think the option is for writers who are not going to be paid for successive republications of their work? I can tell you what the option is. Freelance writers, they're going to stop being freelance writers because they won't be able to make a living at it.
But why? I think it's such a fantasy to think that the income of freelance writers will go up.
It's not
the
simply the income.
It's
the cheapening of the value of your work, and it's the loss of control over its use.
You have no loss of control. The only way you could control its use is to tell them that when they put the newspaper in electronic form, they can't put your piece in it. Since many people want to have the whole newspaper and not a newspaper that's all carved up, that's not a realistic option. So the only option then is to write freestanding pieces or anthologies. But if you want your article in a periodical, I think what we're talking about isn't controlling it in the sense that you just don't want it to touch the cyberspace of the internet. It's to say that you want more money. And, you know, I'm a freelance author too. It's nice to get paid more, but why does any of us think we'd get paid more if the bundle of rights was separately labeled print and electronic? The total that they're going to give us depends on our comparative bargaining power, the demand for our work. It doesn't depend on whether you slice kind of in a, I'm afraid I have to say in a Luddite way, slice the media pie into separate pieces.
Larry Tribe, I know we've got to let you go and polish your act for the Supreme Court.
Right.
You haven't persuaded me yet that if there's new income on an article, it can't be shared with the author, but you may well be able to persuade the Supreme Court. Thank you, Lawrence Tribe, for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you, Wendy.
We're talking about the fight before the Supreme Court over freelancers' rights, freelance writers' rights to a share of the electronic income on their work. Our phone is 617-450-2923. We're joined by Jonathan Tessini, who has filed the original action on behalf of the National Writers Union, and Kenneth Starr, who filed the amicus curiae brief in the Tessini case on behalf of National Geographic magazine. Jonathan Tessini, do you want to remind us why you filed this suit in the beginning?
Well, it's hard to sort of get to that idea through all the rubbish that Larry Tribe put out. I can only say that I hope he does as well in this case as he did in the Florida case. I would say that, you know, we basically filed the case for a couple of reasons. One was the complete disrespect and thievery that the New York Times and their cohorts exhibited by essentially stealing our work. And Larry Tribe likes to refer to the district court and avoid the appeals court decision, because the appeals court decision, a unanimous decision written by the chief judge, who's a conservative judge, no flaming liberal, completely eviscerated the Times' position. This is not like microfilm, and Larry Tribe's argument to the contrary, it's a completely different use. These formats, CD-ROMs, NexisLexis, they are making money for the New York Times, and while they like to sort of say, well, we didn't make any money on this, we're not making money on this, that's irrelevant. In the old print age, remember, just 10 years ago, writers were paid whether the publication made money or not. our contention is very simple. We believe that our case is essentially trying to protect and preserve the constitutional protection for authors. And sometimes we get so bound up in this money that we forget this goes back to the Constitution. And actually, shame on Larry Tribe. I hope in his cocktail circuits in Cambridge, they sort of shake his finger at him. In the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, it says the Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limiting times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. And the basic reason for that was the knowledge on the part of the framers that arts and culture could not progress if authors could not make a fair living.
Kenneth Starr, why can't the publishers share the fruits here?
Well, the issue really is what does Congress provide? And I think in the discussion back and forth, it's important to bear in mind that Congress in 1976 was contemplating how to strike an appropriate balance. We've heard very vigorous articulations from authors as to their perspective and their sense of fairness. And what Congress did, and really what is before the Supreme Court tomorrow, is the fashioning of this particular provision that is now before them for interpretation. And what Congress saw fit to do in trying to, as best it could in 1976, strike the balance was really to say, we want media neutrality. That is to say, we contemplate that new technologies may develop, and we want to give the authors their rights or photographers their rights, but we also want to give the publications, the periodicals, their rights to do what? To have revisions of their work and to use these materials, these articles and photographs.
And the appeals court found that this was not a revision in any sense of the matter.
Well, and excuse me, but I just to complete the thought, that, of course, is exactly what is at issue. Was the appeals court correct? And clearly, the Supreme Court of the United States feels that this is an important issue. Courts of appeals are not always correct. It's my judgment, with all due respect, to a very distinguished panel of the Second Circuit, that the panel got it wrong in its method of interpretation. And I'm speaking now exactly what did Congress have in mind in 1970. Now, if Congress
you're right
believes
that it has to do with going back to 1976, but remember, the revision of 1976, its intention was to make the Copyright Act more friendly to authors. Up until then, if you go back to the 1909 Act, essentially the Copyright Act was entirely publisher-dominated. So in that context, you cannot read both the legislative intent and the actual language to say that revision means something like the CD-ROMs and NexisNexis. And, Chris, if you went into the street, you know, the law does have some relation to logic. If you went into the street and asked 100 people, is NexisNexis or a CD-ROM anything like the New York Times that you pick up on a newsstand, 100 people will say no. And I think that really should inform, you know, your own listenership about what this issue is about.
Well, I think that is a fundamental disagreement, because the specific product of National Geographic is literally all 108 years of National Geographic available in CD-ROM. And by the way, the National Geographic Society is nonprofit, and these proceeds from the sale of this product, which is obviously used by schools for educational purposes and the like, all go to advance the educational mission of the National Geographic Society.
That's irrelevant.
Wendy Kamner.
Irrelevant because writers are not necessarily nonprofit enterprise. And if a nonprofit enterprise chooses to buy my work, it doesn't mean that I'm obliged not to profit from it. That's irrelevant.
It is not at all irrelevant in terms of some of the policy issues that are being articulated, because one of the things we're talking about is not simply for-profit publications. We're talking about a general rule of law that's going to apply across the board and that will have. Now let's come to the policy issue. Is it a reasonable interpretation of the periodicals' rights to, in fact, take the very issues, maintain the integrity of those issues, and simply make those issues available instead of in bound versions for 108 years, as the National Geographic Society does, and to make it conveniently available on CD-ROM. It is the very product. It is the very same complete integrity of that product that the individual subscriber and his or her predecessors over decades subscribed to.
That's not what happens when publishers sell their individual articles to databases like LexisNexis. Readers are not getting the original publication intact. The integrity of the original publication is not being maintained, and that's one of the reasons why the Court of Appeals said that this does not constitute a revision. You're basically just selling off individual articles.
Wendy, one of the things that the Court of Appeals did do was to collapse, and there may be, and we will of course see this tomorrow, arguable distinctions in these various products. But I'm glad that you note the distinction with respect to a CD-ROM, which is one of the products, and Jonathan is equating the two. I think it is very odd to say, in light of Congress's clear desire to have media neutrality, that, in fact, the publication in its intact form cannot be made available on CD-ROM without, again, disrupting these long-understood arrangements between the periodicals and the authors.
I want to say it's time for the callers to be heard. We're talking about ownership rights in cyberspace. More narrowly, freelance writers' rights to the resale value of their work on the web, the Tassini case that will be argued before the Supreme Court tomorrow. Kenneth Starr, Jonathan Tassini, and Wendy Kaminer are our guests. The phone is 617-450-2923. Linda is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Linda.
Yes, hi. This is Linda Weltner. I'm a writer for the Boston Globe, was a former writer for the Boston Globe. It's very interesting to me to hear everybody talk about the altruistic nonprofit motives when in the Globe's motion to dismiss our case, they stated in court documents, quote, "The publication and sale of newspapers is a private enterprise as distinguished from a business affected with a public interest." So they pretty much said that the reason that they could treat its writers the way they did is because they have no interest higher than making a profit.
Linda Weltner, why are you no longer writing for the Boston Globe?
Well, the reason is that because for 20 years I had been writing this piece for the at-home section called Ever So Humble. It was reflections upon my life. It was my life's work. I did very little other writing. And the Globe insisted that as a condition of my continuing to write for them, that I hand over 20 years of my work for no compensation for a period to go 70 years beyond my death, and that they could modify it, adapt it, make e-books, sell it, do just about anything they wanted to it, and that I would no longer have any control nor any profit from my work.
Well, Linda, that really raises a contractual issue that, and whether that is admirable on the part of the Globe or not, that's a contract question as opposed to the issue that the court has before it, which is what are the rights that the publication, the periodical, now has? Because I think this is important in terms of the both integrity of the periodical and then the rights and interests and the fairness to the authors. It would be wrong, and it would obviously be a violation of copyright, and Larry referred to this in his comments. If, for example, if you took a photograph or an article and you sold that separate from the publication, it sounds as if what Linda was subjected to is a contract that would give, if as I understood it, the Globe those rights. That's not the issue. The issue that is here is when it goes into an electronic database like LexisNexis or the pure form of the recreation of the very periodical, the Boston Globe or the New York Times or the National Geographic, is that within the periodical's rights that Congress saw fit to grant or to preserve in the 1976
statute? Ken is right that this the issue that Linda brought up is not at issue directly.
All right, well, may I address
but,
that?
Let me just finish. But I think it's an outrageous practice in and of itself. That is the reason that the Writers Union has supported the lawsuit against the Boston Globe. I want to make sure that we don't forget to address one other what I call piece of gorilla dust that Larry tried to throw up, which Wendy tried to address, which is that if we win, there's going to be these terrible consequences. And I know that they've marched out a few historians, and there'll always be some quislings in any fight.
Be quick, Jonathan. We're going to take a break.
Okay, but the fact is that the PRC that we set up, the Publication Rights Clearinghouse, which is a licensing system, can deal with this. And in fact,
Hold it there, Jonathan. Yep. We'll be back. We're talking about freelancers' rights to the electronic publication of their work. Audio streaming of this program was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from the poet Gail Mazur, whose fourth collection, They Can't Take That Away From Me, is published this month by the University of Chicago Press, available at Amazon.com. Also from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci, from the law firm of Zalkind, Rodriguez, Lunt & Duncan, and from Born to Rush Workshops, Coaching and Counseling, www.geocities.com/ADDCPR. I'm Christopher Lydon. We're talking about the Tassini case before the Supreme Court this week, talking with Jonathan Tassini, who brought the suit on behalf of the National Writers Union, Kenneth Starr, who has written an amicus brief for National Geographic, Wendy Kaminer, a writer, public policy fellow at Radcliffe, frequent op-ed columnist on the New York Times and elsewhere. What is the right of freelance writers to the fruits of their work as they develop on the internet? Let me put it to all of you. We have the Napster problem out there. We also have the ASCAP solution. The Napster question of sort of who can own musical rights in a world that can reproduce these things completely quickly and easily now. You've written, Jonathan Tassini, that the New York Times has a double standard here in that they have opposed the wholesale scorn of copyright in Napster. But we also have the ASCAP solution, which is to say the musical world's distribution of the fruits of musical performance far and wide for most of this century. What is the Napster relevance here, and what is the promise of a ASCAP solution? Jonathan Tassini.
Let me take it those in two parts. The Napster connection is, you know, we talk about Napster and the theft of copyrighted material. The analogy here would be that there's widespread theft going on in the freelance writer world, except the thieves are the very companies that are arguing for copyright protection. It would be Time Warner or the New York Times, and you can go down the list. And I find that slightly hypocritical. And I'll make one other point about that. I think it's to the detriment of these companies to be stealing from freelance writers. They need us to advocate for copyright protection. No one is going to care about stealing a dollar from Time Warner or the New York Times. They might care slightly more if, as individual authors, we were out front arguing for copyright protection. But if the Supreme Court does not affirm our case, essentially, along with these terrible all rights contracts, freelance authors will not own their material, and they will have no interest in protecting copyright. To your second question about ASCAP, in 1994, a year after we filed the lawsuit, I knew right away that we would have to have a solution. There would have to be an end game where we'd have to negotiate with the publishers over this. We set up the analogy to ASCAP. It's called the Publication Rights Clearinghouse, and people can see that on our website at nw.org. And it is working. There is right now, we just set up a searchable million article database in a deal that we have with Contentville and EBSCO, where a writer within 10 or 15 minutes can license their rights. And it is the solution to the very problem we've been talking about.
Kenneth Starr, you probably know the history of ASCAP better than I do, but I just remind you, everybody, that it was built on the copyright law of 1909. It was supposed to remedy, in effect, the poorhouse death of the beloved Stephen Foster, and it became a sort of Tin Pan Alley union that guaranteed payment to Irving Berlin, say, whenever a radio station played God Bless America. Nowadays, there are a billion musical performances a year, including elevator music and circus music and TV background music and nightclub music, and ASCAP does its best to collect on all of them. Why couldn't the publisher world and the writer's world establish a similar payment system?
Well, Chris, there may be some mechanism in the future that is devised, and Jonathan is suggesting that perhaps there are creative ways of resolving these kinds of competing interests, and thus that is a forward-looking kind of issue that goes quite beyond, of course, the more, shall I say, retrospective issue of what do we do about the past? What do we do about these products that do exist in light of the understandings? And again, we have different understandings. Lawsuit was filed in 1993. The law has been on the books since 1976, and these kinds of mechanisms have been in place. So let's separate out the legal questions in terms of legal rights. But I think it's unfortunate to use, you know, pejorative language when we're really talking about very reasonable disagreements as to what, in fact, the law provides, and when the periodical world and the newspaper world, with very honorable people, advised by outside counsel as well as their own inside counsel, has said, we believe that you have this right to do this in light of, again, the concept that Congress seemed to feel so strongly about, which is in order to promote the public interest in accessibility and having information more widely available as long as the integrity of the publication or the periodical was maintained.
If the publishers are acting in the public interest when they republish my work without paying me, then why don't they make it available to the public for free? The publishers are not concerned with the public interest. The publishers are running businesses, and they're concerned with the bottom line. And I also really don't share your notion that publishers all act honorably, that they've all been advised by honorable people, that this is a reasonable interpretation of the law, and that's why they should do it. I suspect that they were advised by their lawyers that this was an interpretation of the law that they might get away with, and that writers, we all know, are not very well organized, have no negotiating power, and that chances are they could put our articles out electronically and not be sanctioned for it.
Well, I would have to respectfully disagree, and I would just say that, you know, reference has been made to the Second Circuit's opinion, and I, again, with all respect to the Second Circuit, think they really got the answer wrong. And I'm not talking about the policy issue. I'm talking about the specific statutory interpretation issue. But I do refer you back to Judge Sotomayor's opinion, which is
That's
the district court's opinion, which is a very elaborate, I believe, very scholarly examination of the entirety of the law, its background, its context, and I think that it's that same set of materials that lawyers, both in-house and outside counsel, had before them in providing the advice that they did.
We'll see how the Supreme Court resolves it. I want to introduce John Perry Barlow, who is a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a Berkman Fellow at the Harvard Law School. He's also a songwriter and, I believe, a member of ASCAP. Are you not?
I am
John?
A member of ASCAP. All the good it does me.
Guide us through this thicket toward a solution, John.
Well, I'm either a good person for that or a bad person for
good
that.
Good luck.
Because this is one of the areas involving copyright where I am truly of a mixed opinion.
Let's hear both sides then.
On the one hand, I'm a strong believer that a creator should have the ability to exercise some control over the destiny of his or her work. I am generally appalled by the
tactics and behavior of the publishers around electronic copyright, especially with regard to Napster. But the bottom line for me, generally, is the public's right to know. And I feel that whatever is going to serve the greatest distribution of knowledge to the most people for the longest period of time is the thing that we need to be optimizing for. And I'm afraid that that tends to put me in the publisher's camp.
This is an interesting argument.
As I find that, it's the right to know which has motivated me so strongly to oppose the publisher's interest in the area of music and film.
This is an interesting question, and it is the sort of showbiz rule that the audience here must be served, and in the collection and dissemination of data, that universal access to everything, in a certain sense, is what's going to serve knowledge in the long run.
There's another issue.
How is knowledge created if creators aren't going to make a living?
Well, I would be very surprised, and you know, as a matter of principles, I say, Jonathan, I do support the writers, but I would be very, very surprised if there were many of your writers who would not write if they didn't think that they weren't going to get some payment for the
Oh, I think that's absolutely not true. That's absolutely not true. And there are a number of writers who have stopped writing for the Boston Globe because the Boston Globe has essentially demanded that they turn over all of their copyrights to the newspaper. When writers lose the ability to profit from their work or to control their work, they will stop producing it. And
but
I don't see how that serves the public's right to know.
As a matter of principle, I agree with that. I mean, I was appalled by the comments of the earlier lady, and I forget her name, who wrote for the Boston Globe and was told that her life's work suddenly belonged to them in some insidious way. I think that's really kind of awful, but at the same time, as a practical matter, how much was she likely to get monetarily, and would that actually incentivize her to do more of this?
Could I ask a question to Jonathan Tessini, and it bears on the Napster case? There are musicians out there, Jonathan, who feel Napster is good for them, even if people get their work free. Most of the money was going to the record companies, not to them, and if they have free access to the universal audience through the web, there'll be more people at their concerts. They'll make it back in their careers on the free notoriety they get for their recordings. What would be an equivalent compensation for writers that would give them an interest in universal dissemination of their work?
Remember, we are for universal dissemination of our work. All we want to do is have the right to control that and have a fair remuneration. In fact, the collection of many, many royalties over time, if it's 5 cents here and 5 cents there, will make it possible to have a middle-class living for writers. We're not against dissemination of works, and in fact, I would say it's one reason that the librarians, the main library groups, have sided with us, not the publishers. Those very institutions, who I'm sure John supports and probably is aligned with, those very institutions are saying that this is very important for them as libraries to make sure that creators can make a living. Otherwise, they won't have works for their public.
Ken Starr, do you want to leap in here?
Well, I think, again, that the value of dissemination and the like really is brought, I think, into very sharp focus when we compare two situations. And let's go back to Linda's concern, sign over all your copyright rights to us. And again, to make sure that the audience understands that is not the issue before us, and in terms of the Napster kind of set of issues and the like, I think there's numerous distinctions between those two situations. And I think the best way to get at it is to look at it this way. Let us say that for National Geographic, a photographer or a freelance author contributes his or her piece or work. That then appears in, and the individual is paid for that article or that photograph to appear in a print copy of National Geographic. The concept of making it available through a media-neutral form on CD-ROM, we believe, again, is sanctioned by the law, that's exactly what the law contemplated. Again, that's what the issue is about. But now let's separate that out, and let's say a particular article was so terrific that then, let's say Sports Illustrated, one of the parties to the litigation says, let's have the best of Sports Illustrated, an entirely different kind of thing than maintaining the integrity of that same article. And that's what we're really talking about. It's important, but it's also very narrow. If Sports Illustrated tries to use photograph or article to create some new kind of work, then that copyright right of the author or of the photographer carries over, and the individual must be compensated unless there's been some other contractual arrangement, which is exactly what the Boston Globe is trying to achieve. If National Geographic saw fit, for example, to create a poster from a photograph that was especially popular, that would again not that would be a compensable event, so that that photographer or that author would in fact be compensated for that additional utilization. The specific issue here is what happens when the material from the New York Times is turned over to a database and is identified as part of the New York Times. It is still the New York Times. The article appeared.
No, it's not still the New York Times. It's one article that was taken from the New York Times.
Okay, the debate becomes fairly metaphysical.
I'm just saying it's not metaphysical to me.
Well, okay.
No, fair enough.
It is the argument. It does take on a certain philosophical quality. The point I'm trying to make, and let's stick with the CD-ROM, which I think, first of all, that's the National Geographic.
Look, hang on.
It's time for the callers. Yeah. I don't want to beat that one to death. It is a kind of philosophical question as to whether the CD-ROM or the LexisNexis reprint is the late 20 years later edition of the New York Times or something else. The Supreme Court will resolve that. I want to get back to general questions with callers. Our phone is 617-450-2923 with Ken Starr, Jonathan Tessini, Wendy Kaminer, and John Perry Barlow. Ken is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Ken.
It is wonderful to have you back
in
any form whatsoever. I'm a freelancer, and I try to see both sides of the question, but one observation I've made about all discussions about copyright law is that there's an important distinction. The way copyright law, the way I see copyright law being interpreted, copyright law currently protects the copyright holder. It was designed to protect the creator, but if the creators sign away those copyrights, then in the end you've got a system that doesn't protect the original creators. This happens quite a lot in the recording industry.
Right.
I'm not sure how much it happens in writing, so I think that's an important distinction to make when you frame any debate about copyright.
But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking here about cases in which the creators have not signed away their copyrights.
Mm-hmm.
They've relied on federal copyright law, and they are interpreting federal copyright law very differently than the way publishers are interpreting the federal copyright law.
But there's also
law.
A question of what copyright is worth to you, Ken. If you're sitting out in the woods having written the thing, but everybody's going someplace else to get your work. In Linda Weltner's case, for example, she owns the copyright, but people aren't going to come up to her doorstep to get her columns. So what good does it do her?
What I was going to say was that I think the real point of contention here may not be so much law as power and who's going to be able to, I don't want to say put the arm on people, but how much weight are the publishers going to have to say you must sign over your copyright law or we'll shut you out of the market? And that's a debate that's going to continue.
Well, that's not a debate. That's a fact of life.
That's what I agree.
Right. And publishers, like the Boston Globe, has refused to use freelancers who don't sign this very onerous contract. And so now the paper is relying much more on wire services for its material. I don't know that the public's right to know is well served by that.
John Perry Barlow, I wish you'd speak to the power issue here.
Hi.
Are you there, John?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to speak to the power question here, as well as the
obviously, we're talking about what might be translated into power, but I think power is either symbolic or it's practical. Now, practically, I just don't see that much power is being delivered to the writers, except in those extreme cases where you have a publisher that is behaving badly, as in the case of the Boston Globe. To the extent that economic power is involved, I'd like to ask Jonathan, what is the most that any writer has been paid for in an annual royalty amount from the National National Publication Clearinghouse?
Jonathan Tessini.
The most that someone has been paid, I believe, was about $1,500, which, you know, frankly, for
that doesn't change anybody's socioeconomic.
Well, look,
but if you're a struggling freelance writer who's making $15,000 a year, that's 10% of your income.
For an average freelance writer, $1,500, I know it may be, I know, not a lot of money for, you know, rich people and people who have done well in other ways. That is a significant amount, and the point is not where we are now, but where we want to be in 10 years. And I firmly believe that if our system is put in place, if publishers stop stealing our work and also are fair to us and negotiate fairly over those revenue streams, and we get a fair royalty for that, that the aggregated amounts of all these uses, from CD-ROMs, from websites, and so on, will afford most writers, and not just writers, by the way, photographers, illustrators, these are hundreds of thousands of creators throughout the country, will afford us a middle-class living.
My concern is that you know, while I applaud your efforts to create an expediting solution, that what we're really talking about is getting more money to the lawyers and the agencies that sort out rights.
We don't want to do that.
I'm afraid that that's going to be the net effect.
But that's why we're running. That's precisely why we set up this system as an author-run system. We have no interest in making money here. All we do is deliver the royalties to the writer.
I would warn you, you know, speaking as a member of ASCAP, which is probably an author-run system, at some point in there, the authors that become administrators realize that they are first in line for the money.
Caller's turn.
I think that's a fair point.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. Charles is on the line. Charles, are you there? Charles, try it again. 617-450-2923. Steve is calling from New York City.
Yeah, hey, great show.
Thank you, Steve.
It seems like, you know, what we're really talking about is digital publishing rights, and that would cover text, audio, and music. And so, you know, in light of the NAPSA ruling, the stance of the newspaper seems illegal, you know, because an extension or test of the newspaper's position would be for them to publish digital music files all on Napster and claim it's just a revision. I mean, this just seems ludicrous.
Well, there is a conflict here. The New York Times editorialized in the Napster case that the Internet, though it is a revolutionary medium, should not become, as the Times said, a duty-free zone where people can plunder the intellectual property of others without paying for it. And the court upheld that view, shutting down Napster. Why? How can the New York Times, Ken Starr, and you can rule on this because you're not representing them, how can they take both positions, that it's a duty-free zone where freelance articles are concerned, but not where Napster songs are involved?
Because, again, I think of the retrospective nature of what this controversy is about. That is to say, the New York Times has, in fact, entered into a contract and has made payments. And the issue is, to what extent did that purchase of that right to publish that particular article or that particular freelance photograph, if it was that case, to what extent does that carry on? And again, the narrow issue, very important issue from this retrospective look at what Congress was trying to do in 1976 is, gee, does that mean that you can, in fact, do anything you want to with it? No, it does not. That's not, the balance that Congress struck. So I see the two as being very different, because here you have essentially a contractual dispute informed then by the overlay of the background of what Congress, in fact,
provided.
This is not
a contractual dispute. I have written numerous articles for the New York Times. I have never entered into a contract with them. I've simply sold them my article, assuming that federal copyright law is only giving them one-time use. This is not a contractual dispute, and they're basing their claim on their interpretation of their collective copyright under federal copyright law.
Well, that's right, but Wendy, it cannot be that the New York Times had one-time use, and yet the law so specifically provides, and we again can argue the point, but it cannot be that they had the right to use it one time only when it specifically provides that they can use it for a revision and then any later collective work.
Yes, and as we all know, the fight is about whether or not selling articles to electronic databases constitutes a revision, and that's what you'll be arguing about in the court this week.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. Charles is back on the line. Welcome, Charles.
Oh, thank you, Chris. How are you?
Good.
Chris, I'm a colleague of Larry Tribe's and listened to him intently. And
at the Harvard Law School. Charles,
yes.
Could this be Charles Nesson himself?
Certainly is. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Colleagues of, almost all of the folks there. A question, though, for Ken Starr. Ken, you seem to put a lot of weight on the argument that a CD-ROM is like a republication of the whole of the National Geographic. And I can see that there's some sense to that. But to me, there's a very different quality to the LexisNexis database and a very different experience from a user. If I buy the CD-ROM that you're talking about, I buy the whole thing. But when I go to LexisNexis, I go and I search for particular articles, and they seem completely disembodied from the publication as a whole, and so not to be a revision. And I wonder if you're not making an awful lot of hay out of the CD-ROM in order to cover up the weakness on the front where the action really is taking place.
Well, the specific, Charlie, the specific concern, of course, of National Geographic is not LexisNexis. It is, in fact, its CD-ROM product of 108 years of issue. So that's what brought it into the case, including the fact that its activity in this respect is under challenge in litigation in both in Florida and now in the 11th Circuit. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled adversely to National Geographic. I happen to agree that there is a very sensible distinction to be drawn between a CD-ROM, which really does maintain the integrity of that original issue, and then the kind of database, electronic database, represented in this litigation by LexisNexis. Still and all, Charlie, even though I see the distinction, it also seems to me that the utilization of a LexisNexis or other electronic base, with all of the wonderful advantages that provides, fits, in my reading of this, very comfortably within the idea of a revision of the collective work.
Ken Starr, could I just throw in my own question on this? It seems to me we ought to get real about the actual trend here, in which, you know, the electronic version of the New York Times is not going to be one little tiny afterthought. For most people, it's going to be the paper. I know lots of people now who read the Times exclusively on the web, and there will be more and more in the future. That's going to be, in effect, the main edition. It's not going to be, people going to the Omaha Public Library to see the microfilm of 20 years ago. It's going to be the main event. How do we deal with that developing truth about the activity on the web, that this is the real thing?
Well, there are really two ways of doing it. The forward-looking is through the kind of contractual arrangements or the kinds of creative solutions that have been talked about here. And the other is, if we can't effect that in a way that seems to strike that sensible balance, in other words, if there is market failure, then this is ultimately the kind of question that Congress should sit and resolve and to say, look, we clearly have folks here who have very starkly differing views as to what is right and what is fair and what is reasonable. So how are we going to strike that balance? Is the 76 balance the right one, or do we need to re-examine it?
We're going to listen carefully to the Supreme Court. That's how we're going to do it. Ken Starr, you get the last word as it happens. Thank you for joining us. Ken Starr, Wendy Kaminer, John Perry Barlow, and earlier Lawrence Tribe and Jonathan Tessini. Thanks also to Campbell Ellsworth, to Feature Story News in Washington, D.C., to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School, and to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming. Our show was done in the broadcast and multimedia production studios of the Christian Science Monitor by the venerable team of Dan First, Tom Tiger, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Catherine Bidwell, and Jake Shapiro. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please visit us at www.christopherlydon.org.